Light travels quite slowly on the disk, due to the braking effect of the huge magical field, and currently that part of the rim carrying the island of Krull was directly under the little sun's orbit, and it was therefore still early evening. It was also quite warm, since the rim picks up more heat and enjoys a gentle maritime climate. In fact, Krull, with a large part of what, for want of a better word, must be called its coastline, sticking out over the edge, was a fortunate island. The only native Krullians who did not appreciate this were those who didn't look where they were going, or who walked in their sleep, and because of natural selection, there weren't very many of them anymore. All societies have their share of dropouts, but on Krull, they never had a chance to drop back in again. Terpsich Mims was not a dropout. He was an angler. There is a difference. Angling is more expensive. But Terpsich was happy. He was watching a feather on a cork bob gently on the gentle reed-lined waters of the Hakral River, and his mind was very nearly a blank. The only thing that could have disturbed his mood was actually catching a fish, because catching fish was the one thing about angling that he really dreaded. They were cold and slimy and panicky and got on his nerves, and Terpsich's nerves weren't very good. So long as he caught nothing, Terpsich Mims was one of the disk's happiest anglers, because the Hakral River was 5 miles from his home, and therefore 5 miles from Mrs. Gladys Mims, with whom he had enjoyed 6 happy months of married life. That had been some 20 years previously. Terpsich did not pay undue heed when another angler took up station further along the bank. Of course, some fishermen might have objected to this breach of etiquette, but in Terpsich's book, anything that reduced his chance of actually catching any of the damn things was all right by him. Out of the corner of his eye, he noted that the newcomer was fly-fishing, an interesting pastime, which Terpsich had rejected because one spent altogether far too much time at home making the equipment. He had never seen fly-fishing like this before. There were wet flies and there were dry flies, but this fly augured into the water with a saw-toothed whine and dragged the fish out backwards. Terpsich watched in horrified fascination as the indistinct figure behind the willow trees cast and cast again. The water boiled as the river's entire piscine population fought to get out of the way of the buzzing terror, and unfortunately a large and maddened pike took Terpsich's hook out of sheer confusion. One moment he was standing on the bank, and the next he was in a green, clanging gloom, bubbling his breath away, and watching his life flash before his eyes, and even in a moment of drowning, dreading the thought of watching the bit between the day of his wedding and the present. It occurred to him that Gladys would soon be a widow, which cheered him up a little bit. In fact, Terpsich had always tried to look on the bright side, and it struck him, as he sank gratefully into the silt, that from this point on, his whole life could only improve. And a hand grabbed his hair and dragged him to the surface, which was suddenly full of pain. Ghastly blue and black blotches swam in front of his eyes, his lungs were on fire, his throat was a pipe of agony. Hands, cold hands, freezing hands, hands that felt like a glove full of dice, towed him through the water and threw him down on the bank, where after some game attempt to get on with drowning, he was eventually bullied back into what passed for his life. Terpsich didn't often get angry, because Gladys didn't hold with it, but he felt cheated. He'd been born without being consulted. He'd been married because Gladys and her father had seen to it, and the only major human achievement that was uniquely his had been rudely snatched away from him. A few seconds ago, it had all been so simple. Now it was all complicated again. Not that he wanted to die, of course. The gods were very firm on the subject of suicide. He just hadn't wanted to be rescued. Through red eyes in a mask of slime and duckweed, he peered at the blurred form above him and shouted, "Why did you have to save me?" The answer worried him. He thought about it as he squelched all the way home. It sat at the back of his mind while Gladys complained about the state of his clothes. It squirreled around in his head as he sat and sneezed guiltily by the fire, because being ill was another thing Gladys didn't hold with. And as he lay shivering in bed, it settled in his dreams like an iceberg. In the midst of his fever, he muttered, "What did he mean, for later?" Torches flared in the city of Stolat. Whole squads of men were charged with the task of constantly renewing them. The streets glowed. The sizzling flames pushed back shadows that had been blamelessly minding their own business every night for centuries. They illuminated ancient corners where the eyes of bewildered rats glittered in the depths of their holes. They forced burglars to stay indoors. They glowed on the night mists, forming a nimbus of yellow light that blotted out the cold high flames streaming from the hub. But mainly, they shone on the face of Princess Kaylee. It was everywhere. It plastered every flat surface. Binky cantered along the glowing streets between Princess Kaylee on doors, walls and gable ends. Mort gaped at posters of his beloved on every surface where workmen had been able to make paste stick. Even stranger, no one seemed to be paying them much attention. While Stowe Lart's nightlife was not as colourful and full of incidents as that of Ankh Morpork, in the same way that a waste paper basket cannot compete with a municipal tip, the streets were nevertheless a-bustle with people, and shrill with the cries of hucksters, gamblers, sellers of sweetmeats, pea and thimble men, ladies of assignation, pickpockets, and the occasional honest trader who had wandered in by mistake and couldn't now raise enough money to leave. As Mort rode through them, snatches of conversation in half a dozen languages floated into his ears. With numb acceptance, he realized he could understand every one of them. He eventually dismounted and led the horse along Wall Street, searching in vain for Cutwell's house. He found it only because a lump on the nearest poster was making muffled swearing noises. He reached out gingerly and pulled aside a strip of paper.
"Thanks very much," said the gargoyle door knocker. "You wouldn't credit it, would you? 1 minute life as normal, next minute a mouthful of glue."
"Where's Cutwell?"
"He's gone off to the palace."
The knocker leered at him and winked a cast iron eye.
"Some men came and took all his stuff away. Then some other men started pasting pictures of his girlfriend all over the place. Bastards,"
it added. Mort coloured.
"His girlfriend?"
The door knocker, being of the demonic persuasion, sniggered at his tone. It sounded like fingernails being dragged over a file.
"Yes," it said. "They fiend in a bit of a hurry, if you ask me."
Mort was already up on Binky's back.
"I say,"
shouted the knocker at his retreating back,
"I say, could you unstick me, boy?"
Mort tugged on Binky's rein so hard that the horse reared and danced crazily backwards across the cobbles, then reached out and grabbed the ring of the knocker. The gargoyle looked up into his face and suddenly felt like a very frightened door knocker indeed. Mort's eyes glowed like crucibles, his expression was a furnace, his voice held enough heat to melt iron. It didn't know what he could do, but felt that it would probably prefer not to find out.
"What did you call me?"
Mort hissed. The door knocker thought quickly.
"Sir?"
it said.
"What did you ask me to do?"
"Unstick me."
"I don't intend to."
"Fine," said the door knocker. "Fine, that's okay by me. I'll just stick around then."
It watched Mort canter off along the street and shuddered with relief, knocking itself gently in its nervousness.
"A narrow squeak,"
said one of the hinges.
"Shut up."
Mort passed the night watchman, whose job now appeared to consist of ringing bells and shouting the name of the princess, but a little uncertainly, as if they had difficulty remembering it. He ignored them, because he was listening to voices inside his head, which went, "She's only met you once, you fool. Why should she bother about you?"
"Yes, but I did save her life." "That means it belongs to her, not to you. Besides, he's a wizard." "So what? Wizards aren't supposed to go out with girls. They're celebrate."
"Celebrate?
They're not supposed to, you know."
"What, never any, you know, at all?" said the internal voice, and it sounded as if it was grinning.
"It's supposed to be bad for the magic," thought Mort bitterly. "Funny place to keep magic."
Mort was shocked.
"Who are you?" he demanded.
"I'm you, Mort, your inner self."
"Well, I wish I'd get out of my head. It's quite crowded enough with me in here."
"Fair enough," said the voice. "I was only trying to help. But remember, if you ever need you, you're always around." The voice faded away. "Well," thought Mort bitterly, "that must have been me. I'm the only one that calls me Mort." The shock of the realization quite obscured the fact that while Mort had been locked into the monologue, he had ridden right through the gates of the palace. Of course, people rode through the gates of the palace every day, but most of them needed the things to be opened first. The guards on the other side were rigid with fear because they thought they'd seen a ghost. They would have been far more frightened if they'd known that a ghost was almost exactly what they hadn't seen. The guard outside the doors of the great hall had seen it happen too, but he had time to gather his wits, or such that remained, and raise his spear as Binky trotted across the courtyard.
"Halt," he croaked. "Halt! What goes where?"
Mort saw him for the first time.
"What?"
he said, still lost in thought. The guard ran his tongue over his dry lips and backed away. Mort slid off Binky's back and walked forward.
"I meant, well, what goes there?"
The guard tried again, with a mixture of doggedness and suicidal stupidity that marked him for early promotion. Mort caught the spear gently and lifted it out of the way of the door. As he did so, the torchlight illuminated his face. "Mort," he said softly. It should have been enough for any normal soldier, but this guard was officer material.
"I mean, friend or foe," he stuttered, trying to avoid Mort's gaze.
"Which would you prefer?" he grinned. It wasn't quite the grin of his master, but it was a pretty effective grin, and didn't have a trace of humour in it. The guard sagged with relief and stood aside.
"Pass, friend," he said.
Mort strode across the hall towards the staircase that led to the royal apartments. The hall had changed a lot since he last saw it. Portraits of Kay Lee were everywhere. They'd even replaced the ancient and crumbling battle banners in the shadowy heights of the roof. Anyone walking through the palace would have found it impossible to go more than a few steps without seeing a portrait. Part of Mort's mind wondered why, just as another part worried about the flickering dome that was steadily closing on the city. But most of his mind was a hot and steamy glow of rage and bewilderment and jealousy. Isabel had been right, he thought. This must be love. "The walk through walls, boy!" He jerked his head up. Cutwell was standing at the top of the stairs. The wizard had changed a lot, too, Mort thought bitterly. Perhaps not that much, though. Although he was wearing a black and white robe embroidered with sequins, although his pointy hat was a yard high and decorated with more mystic symbols than a dental chart, and although his red velvet shoes had silver buckles and toes that curled like snails, there were still a few stains on his collar, and he appeared to be chewing. He watched Mort climb the stairs towards him.
"Are you angry about something?" he said. "I started work, but I got rather tied up with other things. Very difficult walking through. Why are you looking at me like that?"
"What are you doing here?"
"I might ask you the same question. Would you like a strawberry?"
Mort glanced at the small wooden punnet in the wizard's hands.
"In midwinter?"
"Actually, they're sprouts with a dash of enchantment."
"They taste like strawberries?"
Cutwell sighed.
"No, like sprouts. The spell isn't totally efficient. I thought they might cheer the princess up, but she threw them at me. Shame to waste them. Be my guest."
Mort gaped at him.
"She threw them at you?"
"Very accurately, I'm afraid. Very strong-minded young lady."
"Hi," said a voice in the back of Mort's mind. "It's you again. Pointing out to yourself that the chances of the princess even contemplating you know with this fellow are on the far side of remote." "Go away," thought Mort.
His subconscious was worrying him. It appeared to have a direct line into parts of his body that he wanted to ignore at the moment.
"Why are you here?" he said aloud. "Is it something to do with all these pictures?"
"Good idea, wasn't it?" beamed Cutwell. "I'm rather proud of it myself."
"Excuse me," said Mort weakly. "I've had a busy day. I think I'd like to sit down somewhere."
"There's the throne room," said Cutwell. "There's no one there at this time of night. Everyone's asleep."
Mort nodded and then looked suspiciously at the young wizard.
"What are you doing up then?" he said.
Said Cutwell. I just thought I'd see if there was anything in the pantry." He shrugged.
There had been half a jar of elderly mayonnaise, a piece of very old cheese, and a tomato with white mould growing on it. Since during the day the pantry of the Palace of Stow Lut normally contained 15 whole stags, 100 brace of partridges, 50 hogsheads of butter, 200 jugs of hares, 75 sides of beef, 2 miles of assorted sausages, various fowls, 80 dozen eggs, several Circle Sea sturgeon, a vat of caviar and an elephant's leg stuffed with olives, Cutwell had learned, once again, that one universal manifestation of raw natural magic through the universe is this, that any domestic food store raided furtively in the middle of the night always contains, no matter what its daytime inventory, half a jar of elderly mayonnaise, a piece of very old cheese, and a tomato with white mould growing on it. Now is the time to report that Cutwell, too, notices that Mort, even a Mort weary with riding and lack of sleep, is somehow glowing from within, and in some strange way, unconnected with size, is nevertheless larger than life. The difference is that Cutwell is by training a better guesser than other people, and knows that in occult manners the obvious answer is usually the wrong one. Mort can move absent-mindedly through walls and drink neat widow-maker soberly, not because he is turning into a ghost, but because he is becoming dangerously real. In fact, as the boy stumbles while they walk along the silent corridors and steps through a marble pillar without noticing, it's obvious that the world is becoming a pretty insubstantial place from his point of view.
"You just walked through a marble pillar," observed Cutwell. "How did you do it?"
"Did I?" Mort looked round. The pillar looked sound enough. He poked an arm towards it and slightly bruised his elbow.
"I could have sworn you did," said Cutwell. "Wizards notice these things, you know."
He reached into the pocket of his robe.
"Then have you noticed the mist dome around the country?" said Mort.
Cutwell squeaked. The jar in his hand dropped and smashed on the tiles, and there was the smell of slightly rancid salad dressing.
"Already?"
"I don't know about already," said Mort, "but there's this sort of crackling wall sliding over the land, and no one else seems to worry about it, and
how fast was it moving?"
"It changes things."
"You saw it?"
"How far away is it? How fast is it moving?"
"Of course I saw it. I rode through it twice. It was like..."
"But you're not a wizard, so why...
What are you doing here, anyway?"
Cutwell took a deep breath.
"Everyone shut up," he screamed.
There was silence. Then the wizard grabbed Mort's arm. "Come on," he said, pulling him back along the corridor.
"I don't know who you are exactly, and I hope I've got time to find out one day, but something really horrible is going to happen soon, and I think you're involved somehow."
"Something horrible? When?"
"That depends on how far away the interface is and how fast it's moving," said Cutwell, dragging Mort down a side passage.
When they were outside a small oak door, he let go of his arm and fumbled in his pocket again, removing a small hard piece of cheese and an unpleasantly squashy tomato.
"Hold these, will you? Thank you."
He delved again, produced a key, and unlocked the door.
"It's going to kill the princess, isn't it?" said Mort.
"Yes," said Cutwell. "And then again, no." He paused with his hand on the door handle.
"That was pretty perspicacious of you. How did you know?"
Mort
hesitated.
"She told me a very strange story," said Cutwell.
"I expect she did," said Mort. "If it was unbelievable, it was true."
"You are him, are you? Death's assistant?"
"Yes. Off duty at the moment, though."
"Pleased to hear it."
Cutwell shut the door behind them and fumbled for a candlestick. There was a pop, a flash of blue light, and a whimper.
"Sorry," he said, sucking his fingers. "Fire spell. Never really got the hang of it."
"You were expecting the dome thing, weren't you?" said Mort, urgently. "What will happen when it closes in?"
The wizard sat down heavily on the remains of a bacon sandwich.
"I'm not exactly sure," he said. "It'll be interesting to watch, but not from inside, I'm afraid. What I think will happen is that the last week will never have existed."
"She'll suddenly die?"
"You don't quite understand. She will have been dead for a week. All this,"
he waved his hands vaguely in the air,
"will not have happened. The assassin will have done his job. You will have done yours. History will have healed itself. Everything will be all right.
From history's point of view, that is.
There really isn't any other."
Mort stared out of the narrow window. He could see across the courtyard into the glowing streets outside, where a picture of the princess smiled at the sky.
"Tell me about the pictures," he said. "That looks like some sort of wizard thing."
"I'm not sure if it's working. You see, people were beginning to get upset, and they didn't know why. And that made it worse. Their minds were in one reality, and their bodies were in another. Very unpleasant. They couldn't get used to the idea that she was still alive. I thought the pictures might be a good idea, but, you know, people just don't see what their mind tells them isn't there."
"I could have told you that," said Mort, bitterly.
"I had the town criers out during the daytime,"
Cutwell continued. "I thought that if people could come to believe her, then this new reality could become the real one."
"Hmph," said Mort. He turned away from the window. "What do you mean?"
"Well, you see, I reckon that if enough people believed in her, they could change reality. It works for gods. If people stop believing in a god, he dies. If a lot of them believe in him, he grows stronger."
"I didn't know that. I thought gods were just gods."
"They don't like it talked about," said Cutwell, shuffling through the heap of books and parchments on his work table.
"Well, that might work for gods because they're special," said Mort. "People are more solid. It wouldn't work for people."
"That's not true. Let's suppose you went out of here and prowled around the palace. One of the guards would probably see you, and he'd think you were a thief, and he'd fire his crossbow. I mean, in his reality, you'd be a thief. It wouldn't actually be true, but you'd be just as dead as if it was. Belief is powerful stuff. I'm a wizard. We know about these things. Look, here."
He pulled a book out of the debris in front of him and opened it at the piece of bacon he'd used as a bookmark. Mort looked over his shoulder and frowned at the curly magical writing. It moved around on the page, twisting and writhing in an attempt not to be read by a non-wizard, and the general effect was unpleasant.
"What's this?" he said.
"It's the Book of the Magic of Alberto Malik, the Mage," said the wizard. "A sort of book of magical theory. It's not a good idea to look too hard to the words. They resent it. Look, it says here..."
His lips moved soundlessly. Little beads of sweat sprang up on his forehead and decided to get together and go down and see what his nose was doing. His eyes watered. Some people like to settle down with a good book. No one in possession of a complete set of marbles would like to settle down with a book of magic, because even the individual words have a private and vindictive life of their own, and reading them, in short, is a kind of mental Indian wrestling. Many a young wizard has tried to read a grimoire that is too strong for him, and people who've heard the screams have found only his pointy shoes with the classic wisp of smoke coming out of them, and a book which is perhaps just a little fatter. Things can happen to browsers in magical libraries that make having your face pulled off by tentacled monstrosities from the dungeon dimensions seem a mere light massage by comparison. Fortunately, Cutwell had an expurgated edition, with some of the more distressing pages clamped shut, although on quiet nights he could hear the imprisoned words scritching irritably inside their prison, like a spider trapped in a matchbox. Anyone who has ever sat next to someone wearing a Walkman will be able to imagine exactly what they sounded like.
"This is the bit," said Cutwell. "It says here that even gods..."
"Oh, you've seen him before!"
"What?"
Mort pointed a shaking finger at the book.
"Him!"
Cutwell gave him an odd look and examined the left-hand page. There was a picture of an elderly wizard holding a book and a candlestick in an attitude of near-terminal dignity.
"That's not part of the magic," he said testily. "That's just the author."
"What does it say under the picture?"
It says, "If you have enjoyed this book, you may be interested in other titles by."
"No, right under the picture is what I meant."
"Oh, that's easy. It's old Malik himself. Every wizard knows him. I mean, he founded the university."
Cutwell chuckled.
"There's a famous statue of him in the main hall, and during Rag Week once I climbed up it and put a..."
Mort stared at the picture.
"Tell me," he said quietly, "did the statue ever drip on the end of its nose?"
"I shouldn't think so," said Cutwell. "It was marble. But I don't know what you're getting so worked up about. Lots of people know what he looked like. He's famous."
"He lived a long time ago, did he?"
2,000 years, I think. Look, I don't know why..."
"I bet he didn't die, though," said Mort. "I bet he just disappeared one day, did he?"
Cutwell was silent for a moment.
"Funny you should say that," he said slowly. "There was a legend I heard. He got up to some strange, weird things, they say. They say he blew himself into the dungeon dimensions while trying to perform the rite of Ash-K'Ente backwards. All they found was his hat. Tragic, really. The whole city in mourning for a day, just for a hat. It wasn't even a particularly attractive hat. It had burn marks on it."
"Alberto Malik," said Mort, half to himself. "Well, fancy that."
He drummed his fingers on the table, although the sound was surprisingly muted.
"Sorry," said Cutwell, "I can't get the hang of treacle sandwiches either."
"I reckon the interface is moving at a slow walking pace," said Mort, licking his fingers absent-mindedly.
"Can't you stop it by magic?"
Cutwell shook his head.
"Not me. It'd squash me flat," he said cheerfully.
"What'll happen to you when it arrives, then?"
"Oh, I'll go back to living in Wall Street. I mean, I never will have left. All this won't have happened. Pity, though. The cooking here is pretty good, and they do my laundry for free. How far away did you say it was, by the way?"
"About 20 miles, I guess."
Cutwell rolled his eyes heavenwards and moved his lips. Eventually he said,
"That means it'll arrive around midnight tomorrow. Just in time for the coronation."
"Whose?"
"Hers. But she's queen already, isn't she?"
"In a way, but officially she's not queen until she's crowned."
Cutwell grinned, his face a pattern of shade in the candlelight, and added,
"If you want a way of thinking about it, then it's like the difference between stopping living and being dead."
20 minutes earlier, Mort had been feeling tired enough to take root. Now he could feel a fizzing in his blood. It was the kind of late-night, frantic energy that you knew you would pay for around midday tomorrow. But for now, he felt he had to have some action, or else his muscles would snap out of sheer vitality.
"I want to see her," he said. "If you can't do anything, there might be something I can do."
"There's guards outside their room," said Cutwell. "I mention this merely as an observation. I don't imagine for one minute that they'll make the slightest difference."
It was midnight in Ankh-Morpork. But in the great twin city, the only difference between night and day was, well, it was darker. The markets were thronged. The spectators were still thickly clustered around the whore pits. Runners-up in the city's eternal and Byzantine gang warfare drifted silently down through the chilly waters of the river with lead weights tied to their feet. Dealers in various illegal and even illogical delights plied their sidelong trade. Burglars burgled. Knives flashed starlight in alleyways. Astrologers started their day's work. And in the shades, a night watchman who had lost his way rang his bell and cried out,
12 o'clock and all's...
However, the Ankh-Morpork Chamber of Commerce would not be happy at the suggestion that the only real difference between their city and a swamp is the number of legs on the alligators. And indeed, in the more select areas of Ankh, which tend to be in the hilly districts where there is a chance of a bit of wind, the nights are gentle and scented with hibiscine and cecilia blossoms. On this particular night, they were scented with saltpeter, too, because it was the 10th anniversary of the accession of the patrician, and he had invited a few friends round for a drink, 500 of them, in this case, and was letting off fireworks. Ankh-Morpork had dallied with many forms of government, and had ended up with that form of democracy known as one man, one vote. The patrician was the man, he had the vote. Laughter and the occasional gurgle of passion filled the palace gardens, and the evening had just got to that interesting stage where everyone had drunk too much for their own good, but not enough actually to fall over. It is the kind of state in which one does things that one will recall with crimson shame in later life, such as blowing through a paper squeaker and laughing so much that one is sick. In fact, some 200 of the patrician's guests were now staggering and kicking their way through the serpent dance, a quaint, more porkian folkway, which consisted of getting rather drunk, holding the waist of the person in front, and then wobbling and giggling uproariously in a long crocodile that wound through as many rooms as possible, preferably ones with breakables in, while kicking one leg vaguely in time with the beat, or at least in time with some other beat. This dance had gone on for half an hour, and had wound through every room in the palace, picking up 2 trolls, 1 cook, the patrician's head torturer, 3 waiters, a burglar who happened to be passing, and a small pet swamp dragon. Somewhere around the middle of the dance was Fat Lord Rodley of Quirm, heir to the fabulous Quirm estates, whose current preoccupation was with the thin fingers gripping his waist. Under its bath of alcohol, his brain kept trying to attract his attention. "I say," he called over his shoulder as they oscillated for the 10th hilarious time through the enormous kitchen, "not so tight, please."
"I am most terribly sorry."
"No offence, old chap. Do I know you?" said Lord Rodley, kicking vigorously on the backbeat.
"I think it unlikely. Tell me, please, what is the meaning of this activity?"
"What?" shouted Lord Rodley above the sound of someone kicking in the door of a glass cabinet amid shrieks of merriment.
"What is the thing that we do?" said the voice, with glacial patience.
"Haven't you been to a party before? Mind the glass, by the way."
"I'm afraid I do not get out as much as I would like to. Please explain this. Does it have to do with sex?"
"Not unless we pull up sharp, old boy, if you know what I mean," said his lordship, and nudged his unseen fellow guest with his elbow. "Ouch," he said. A crash up ahead marked the demise of the cold buffet.
"No."
"What?"
"I do not know what you mean."
"Mind the cream there, it's slippery. Look, it's just a dance, all right. You do it for fun."
"Fun?"
"That's right. Da-da-da-da-da, kick."
There was an audible pause.
"Who is this fun?"
"No, fun isn't anybody. Fun is what you have."
"We are having fun?"
"I thought I was," said his lordship uncertainly.
The voice by his ear was vaguely worrying him. It appeared to be arriving directly into his brain.
"What is this fun?"
"This is..."
"To kick vigorously is fun?"
Well, part of the fun. Kick.
To hear loud music in hot rooms is fun?
Possibly.
How is this fun manifest?
Well, it... Look, either you're having fun or you're not. You don't have to ask me, you just... No, all right. How did you get in here, anyway?
He added.
Are you a friend of the patrician?
Let us say he puts business my way. I felt I ought to learn something of human pleasures.
Sounds like you've got a long way to go.
I know. Please excuse my lamentable ignorance. I wish only to learn. All these people, please. They are having fun?
Yes.
Then this is fun.
I'm glad we've got that sorted out. Mind the chair, snapped Lord Rodley, who was now feeling very unfunny and unpleasantly sober.
A voice behind him said quietly,
This is fun. To drink excessively is fun. We are having fun. He is having fun. This is some fun. What fun?
Behind Death, the patrician's small pet swamp dragon held on grimly to the bony hips and thought, Guards or no guards, next time we pass an open window, I'm going to run like buggery. Kaylee sat bolt upright in bed.
Don't move another step, she said. Guards?
We couldn't stop him,
said the first guard, poking his head shamefacedly round the doorpost.
He just pushed in, said the other guard from the other side of the doorway.
And the wizard said it was all right, and we were told everyone must listen to him, because...
All right, all right. People could get murdered around here, said Kaylee testily, and put the crossbow back on the bedside table without, unfortunately, operating the safety catch. There was a click, the thwack of sinew against metal, a zip of air, and a groan. The groan came from Cutwell. Mort spun round to him.
Are you all right? He said. Did it hit you?
No, said the wizard weakly. No, it didn't. How do you feel?
A bit tired. Why?
Oh, nothing. Nothing. No drafts anywhere. No slight leaking feelings.
No, why?
Oh, nothing, nothing.
Cutwell turned and looked closely at the wall behind Mort.
Aren't the dead allowed any peace? Said Kaylee bitterly. I thought one thing you could be sure of when you were dead was a good night's sleep.
She looked as though she'd been crying. With an insight that surprised him, Mort realized that she knew this, and that it was making her even angrier than before.
That's not really fair, he said. I've come to help. Isn't that right, Cutwell?
Said Cutwell, who had found the crossbow bolt buried in the plaster, and was looking at it with deep suspicion.
Oh, yes, he has. It won't work, though. Excuse me. Has anyone got any string?
Help, snapped Kaylee.
Help? If it wasn't for you, you'd still be dead, said Mort.
She looked at him with her mouth open.
I wouldn't know about it, though, she said. That's the worst part.
I think you two had better go, said Cutwell to the guards, who were trying to appear inconspicuous. But I'll have that spear, please.
Thank you.
Look, said Mort. I've got a horse outside. You'd be amazed. I can take you anywhere. You don't have to wait around here.
You don't know much about monarchy, do you? Said Kaylee.
No.
She means better to be a dead queen in your own castle than a live commoner somewhere else, said Cutwell, who had stuck the spear into the wall by the bolt and was trying to sight along it.
Wouldn't work, anyway. The dome isn't centred on the palace. It's centred on her.
On who? Said Kaylee. Her voice could have kept milk fresh for a month.
On Her Highness, said Cutwell automatically, squinting along the shaft.
Don't you forget it.
I won't forget it, but that's not the point, said the wizard.
He pulled the bolt out of the plaster and tested the point with his finger.
But if you stay here, you'll die, said Mort.
Then I shall have to show the disc how a queen can die, said Kelly, looking as proud as was possible in a pink knitted bed jacket.
Mort sat down on the end of the bed with his head in his hands.
"'I know how a queen can die,' he muttered. "'They die just like other people, and some of us would rather not see it happen.'
"'Excuse me, I just want to look at this crossbow,' said Cutwell conversationally, reaching across them. "'Don't mind me.' "'I shall go proudly to meet my destiny,' said Kaylee.
But there was the barest flicker of uncertainty in her voice.
"'No, you won't. I mean, I know what I'm talking about. Take it from me. There's nothing proud about it. You just die.'
"'Yes.' But it's how you do it.
I shall die nobly, like Queen Ezeriel."
Mort's forehead wrinkled. History was a closed book to him.
"Who's she?"
"She lived in Clatch, and she had a lot of lovers, and she sat on a snake," said Cutwell, who was winding up the crossbow. "She meant to. She was crossed in love."
"All I can remember was that she used to take baths in ass's milk. Funny thing, history," said Cutwell reflectively. "You become a queen, reign for 30 years, make laws, declare war on people, and then the only thing you get remembered for is that you smelled like yoghurt and you were bitten in the..."
"She's a distant ancestor of mine," snapped Kaylee. "I won't listen to this sort of thing."
"Will you both be quiet and listen to me?" shouted Mort.
Silence descended like a shroud. Then Cutwell sighted carefully and shot Mort in the back.